Welcome to the I'm All Over the Place podcast. I'm Dara Starr Tucker. I am so glad to have you with me today for this very, very special episode of the podcast featuring Miss Holly Robinson Peete. If you grew up in the era that I did, you would remember her from 21 Jump Street. That's kind of my first reference for Holly Robinson. But of course, Holly Robinson Peete went on to have a prolific career in television. She did Hanging with Mr. Cooper, which I'm sure we all remember from our childhoods. She married Rodney Peete, who was a football player, and together they founded the Holly Rod Foundation, a wonderful charitable organization that has been going strong for something like 20 years and has really been instrumental in helping families work through difficulties around autism. They also work with Alzheimer's disease. So just a terrific career that Holly Robinson Peete has had thus far, and we will discuss all aspects of it. But I'm doing a special group of episodes for the month of October, four episodes that feature fathers and daughters, and you'll have to stay tuned to find out who my other very, very special guests are. And we're going to end the month with a guest that you would maybe not expect in this series of episodes about fathers and daughters. So I'm really excited about the content that we have coming for you this October. So we're going to talk to Holly about her dad. Her dad is a man named Matt Robinson. And if you're old enough to remember Sesame Street in its early days, you will remember Matt Robinson as the first Gordon on Sesame Street. And he was quite the trailblazer. He worked as a diversity consultant on the show and had just a very interesting and varied past. And Holly had a very, very interesting upbringing. Both her father and mother were pioneers in the entertainment industry. So she will talk some about her upbringing and then how that led her to where she is now in her career. So really excited for you to hear this episode with Holly. She was so dear to come and do this for me after seeing the breakdown that I did on her father, which I will have reposted to YouTube and to all of my socials so you can see kind of the synopsis of the story of her father's time with Sesame Street. But stay tuned for this very special episode of the I'm All Over the Place podcast. You can find me on Patreon, patreon.com/Dara Starr Tucker, Dara with one R, Star with two. You can find me on Instagram at Dara Tucker B. And on all other platforms, X, formerly Twitter, Threads, and TikTok, and YouTube, you can find me at Dara Starr Tucker, Facebook as well. And I also want to let you know that I will be at Blues Alley in Washington, D.C. on the 15th of October. This is 2023, of course. I will be there with my band performing music. I also share a lot of my thoughts that I do in the breakdown and just have some conversation during those shows. I think you'll enjoy it. If you're in the D.C. area or if you have family and friends in D.C., please spread the word. Let them know we are coming to D.C. on Sunday, the 15th of October. I would love to meet you in person. If you are a listener to the podcast, if you're a viewer of The Breakdown, please come by and say hello. I would love to have you. Go to darastartucker.com or you can go to the Blues Alley website at bluesalley.com. So without further ado, we're going to get on to the Holly Robinson Peete episode. Please enjoy, and I hope to see you really, really soon.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for making time for this.
I'm getting ready to drink some coffee because I haven't had that yet, but I was really looking forward to this. Thank you for the awesome, it's not knowledge, but just the presence that you keep out there, not just for my dad, but just for other people. You just really have your finger on the pulse of what it is we need to know. And who we need to remember.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to bring more attention to people like your dad, because honestly, I hadn't even heard. I didn't know. People would always talk about, the first Gordon. He was the first Gordon. And I had heard people say that your dad was the first Gordon, but I never saw him. I never saw clips of the show. I didn't know anything about it before. I don't know when I became aware of him, but it's been very recently, like in the last couple of years. And so, yeah, I think a lot of people are probably in the same position as me and are like, you know, it all feels very mysterious because it was like Sesame Street before, you know, before I knew what was even going on. So,
right. Well, so, and also, it was during a time when, at least, well, you really had to be my age. I'll be in a couple of weeks, I'll be 59. Okay. I'm feeling some kind of way about that.
You look 39, so you should be really good about that.
I feel good about it, but like all the 59-ish things are happening to my body. Yeah. Like, wait. But I say that to say that if you are my age and you remember when Sesame Street started, not the least of which that it was my dad that started it, but just even if people that I meet that are my age, you know, and that were like 4, 5, 6, 7 in the late '60s, they are just like, if they don't know already, cause I talk about it all the time. I'm talking about it for 30 some years, my mm-hmm. whole career. But if they don't know, they trip, because that my dad, the first Gordon, the first 3 or 4 years, it was a different energy.
Mm-hmm.
He brought mm-hmm. something really unique and different. And he brought stuff that was ahead of his time. I was just saying to someone yesterday, because talking about Roosevelt Franklin, his Muppet. And Roosevelt Franklin was so ahead of his time that he was rapping 55 years ago. How old is hip hop? 50? Roosevelt was rapping before rap. That's how far ahead of his time my dad was and his creations were. So anyway, my point is that if you didn't know, people don't know that my dad was Gordon from Sesame Street. He's mm-hmm. usually not the Gordon they remember, but he set that tone.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize until today that he left in 1972. So kind of maybe the story as I'm understanding it isn't quite as I have laid it out, like in terms of the timeline, because I thought he stayed for, I know they said Roosevelt Franklin himself was on there for probably 6 years. So was there a period where he was doing the Roosevelt Franklin character and he was not actually on the show, your dad?
That's a good question. I'll have to ask my mom about that, but I think they had some things in the bank.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure they had stuff like already locked okay. in. That my dad didn't have to be part of until they eventually just phased him out.
Okay. Okay. Cause yeah, I heard that whole uproar happened and maybe like, finally came to a head and probably, you know, I don't know if it was 74, 75 or something like that. And that's when they finally took the character off the show, but your dad had been gone since 72.
Yeah. And the uproar was, you know, basically driven by Black parents.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's at least what we were led to believe at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because my dad was one of the only Black voices in the room in the very early days, he was not able to tell them that it was important that while all the Muppets were different colors and while all the characters were different colors, that the Black children needed to be talked to like Black children.
Mm-hmm.
And that they needed to see themselves not just in other kids in the class and other kids in the school, in the scenes, like with Roosevelt Franklin, for instance, but just they needed to be related to in a certain way and seen in a certain way. And my dad wasn't able to convey that. They really wanted to go with a purple world of, you know, all the Muppets don't have colors. So let's make them purple, but let's not have them act so Black.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a really interesting time. I was way too young to figure it out at the time mm-hmm. what was going on, but I do feel very good about it 50 something years later, because finally, thanks to people like yourself and other people who understand the history of Sesame Street, we are able to get some real information out on the chronology on how all this mm-hmm. unfolded and unpacked. And my brother and my mom and I were part of a really great documentary that I urge everyone to watch called Street Gang, How We Got to Sesame Street. It's about the early days. And they let us, the producers let us, his family, tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned stuff because my mom shared in her portion of it things that I didn't even know.
Wow.
About his frustrations during that time. Mm-hmm. But so when I look up all these years later and see that they've now introduced Black characters, I think that's really interesting. I love mm-hmm. it. So happy. but I just think it's so interesting that it's a Black family and they're talking about washing Black hair and, you know, and the things Black people deal with. I love Sesame Street because they do figure it out
mm-hmm.
at some point. it may take them a minute, but they do figure it out. So props to them. But the irony of having seen my dad try to tell them this very important piece of the audience was not being served completely was interesting. Even when, I mean, over the years, they've obviously done some amazing, they had Jesse Jackson on there talking about I Am Somebody. Like, they had some amazing see things. But when it came to the Muppets, my dad was adamant about how they are not serving a certain part of the community, which was supposed to be the core audience.
Yes. Yeah. And in that documentary that you mentioned, they go out of there, because I did an entire episode of my little, I never know what to call it, like these little micro documentaries called The Breakdown. And I did an entire, you know, breakdown on the fact that Sesame Street was made for inner city kids. And they have, you know, gone out of their way to say that was the core audience. And it was a very different show back then. I mean, even from, you know, your dad's days, it was a different show than what it was by the time, you know, my time came along in the 80s. I guess I never even properly introduced you or talked about what we're going to talk about. If you don't know, this is Miss Holly Robinson Pete.
And
from 21 Jump Street. That's just where that just forever will be where I place you in my mind and in my heart.
I'm okay with that. I love that show. I love that show. I've been watching it. So I'm in my office, and I guess there's one of these, I don't know if it's Samsung or one of them, that just has a whole channel of 21 Jump Street, and it just plays constantly. And I mean, all day long episodes. Yeah. So my assistant put it on and was like, do you know about this channel? And I had heard about it, and I put it on, and I was watching some episodes yesterday that I didn't remember. Like, I was like, what happens next? I don't remember that. But I love that show. I'm very proud of it. I love that character, Judy Hoffs. I wish I could have been her forever. I wish I could be on that show still. I would be the captain by now. Mayor or something, running something. But I love that show, and I'm glad you have an appreciation for it.
Yeah, I just have fun. Yeah, really vague memories, actually, but very fond memories of just that being the period of time where I became, and most people became, aware of you. But of course, some folks will know you from hanging with Mr. Cooper. Some folks, and what else can you just kind of throw out a couple of things?
Well, it's weird because after I went from Jump Street to Cooper, and it was, it came one after the other, right? And so I went from this serious drama where I was, you know, helping kids in high school get over all the kind of issues that were going on in the world. And then, like, from that, I become Vanessa, my character from Hanging with Mr. Cooper, who's just goofy as hell and very materialistic. But also very fun to play. But the thing about that was I had to convince the producers that I could be funny. That's a different, totally different muscle going from 1 hour episodic to, you know, half hour comedy, four cameras in front of a live audience. That's a different vibe. So I had to prove that I could do that. And boy, was that fun. I'm so glad I got a chance to do that. I have the best memories of that show of Cooper, especially because my husband proposed to me on the set there. So that was extra dope, amazing. But beyond that, after that, I did a show called For Your Love, which, when I tell you, out of all the shows I've done, it is my favorite in that, just on the levels of writing, on what it brought to television. It was about three different couples and three different stages of love. We were on NBC. We were on a big network. After That About You, which was a huge hit for them. And then our numbers were really good, but there was some political something that happened. And we ended up on the WB. That time was really taking advantage of some of these Black shows that were not getting the love, but even though they were really, really good. So went on to do For Your Love, and love that. And then after that, just, you know, bounced around a lot from different types of gigs. Did Mike and Molly for a while, and Chicago Fire for a while, and had fun just doing different characters and bridging that gap between comedy and drama. Did that famous Diana Ross job on Jackson's An American Dream to this day. Probably my most watched piece of work because they run that every 5 seconds on VH1. And it still gets played a lot. That was a dream come true, that job. I still can't believe that, A, I got to do that. I got to work with Vanessa Williams and Angela Bassett and Larry. Mm. All those talented kids that played the Jackson family. And Terrence Howard, who people don't even realize was there and was on there, played Jackie. But yeah, just bounced around. But at the end of the day, and I think you know this about me, that I am, my focus is philanthropy.
Yes.
So like I've been running this nonprofit, Holly Rod Foundation, for 25 years. And that's like my fifth child. That's where my heart is. So while I enjoy being on TV, I love it. I don't sit around and go, oh, I wish I could win an Emmy or Oscar. I sit around going, oh, I hope I can get this grant. Wow. I hope I can get more RJ's places. That's sort of where my heart is. Mm-hmm. Currently, I'm doing a new show called Queen's Court. So Queen's Court is a dating show, a twist on a dating show that my husband and I host for Peacock. We did it last season. It did very well, and we're gonna shoot the next season very, very shortly. So that's it on my little bio. Now I'll let you talk.
Well, I it's kind of interesting because I really don't do a whole lot of interviews for the podcast at all. We're more of kind of like, you know, we'll pick a theme, pick a topic, and just kind of discuss that and talk about, you know, lots of cultural issues around, you know, whatever race or whatever happens to be going on. But I just kind of, I have kind of gotten into a spate of doing just a few interviews, a handful of interviews, and you're one of them. And you know, because I've bugged you and I've come back a couple of times and been like, hey, do you have time? Is this a good time? But I have really wanted to talk to you specifically about your dad. And I just had a conversation with Bernie Mac's daughter, Janice McCullough.
Oh, I love Janice.
You know everyone. I realized from the pictures of your the anniversary of your foundation. I'm like, Holly is connected to everybody.
That's from being around so long. That's really what and getting up in people's faces.
But yeah, I just had a conversation with her about her dad. And then in a couple of weeks, I'm going to have a conversation with Layla Hathaway about her dad.
Nice.
And so yeah, we're going to have this kind of nice little trifecta of interviews. Again, I don't do that very often, but just kind of had a, I don't know, like a pull to like talk about dads. And maybe it's because my dad has been on my mind lately or something, but we're just in a dad zone. And so, I just want to kind of get at that, I guess, that thing that only children can really zero in on about their parents. I mean, you speak, and your brother would be able to speak from a very specific point of view that no one else would be able to have, you know, of him and who he was on a fundamental level. So really, I kind of want to, I'm in Philly now. I live in Philly, and I haven't even been here a year. So I don't know the city.
That's already setting the stage. That's already giving me vibes. Go ahead.
So I don't know the city very much because the kind of work that I do, it just leaves me indoors all the time. And every once in a while I'll get out. So I don't feel like I really have like bonded with the city yet. So what is, I guess I want to first ask, like, what your relationship is with Philly. Were you born here? How long did you stay? Did you eventually move to New York with your dad? Like, what, you know, you and Philly, how does that work?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It's Joseph M. Wanted with the Christitutionalist Politics. Tune in for the upcoming episode for May 4. Issue, never the issue, as well as, yes, Peter Serafin, Rosemary Downer, Don Gallade, Gista the rapper, Cy Young, Jason Perry, and upcoming Jack Hagar, Andrew Thorpe King, Trent Rock, Ed Temple, Chris Morehouse, and more. Please tune in to Christitutionalist Politics. God bless.
Whew, me and Philly. A very intense relationship.
Mm.
I was born in Philadelphia at Lincoln Hospital in Philadelphia. My life, my roots, my heart is in Philly. Mm. My mother and my father, both their families were born in Philly. So it's Philly all day long.
Yeah.
Lived in West Philadelphia for a while. And then my dad, when he got Sesame Street, we, like the Jeffersons, we went on up to Mount Airy. And Mount Airy was, at the time, in the late 60s, Mount Airy was just like the utopian neighborhood. Oh. I'm talking, we had everybody. We had Blacks, whites, Jews. We had even had families from Iraq, from Japan, from, it was the melting pot. Like the people that were there were from all walks of life. And it gave me a kumbaya type of childhood start. Yeah. Like I didn't understand what any place that didn't have diversity, what that meant. Right. Because that was everything. My neighbors, we celebrated, Hanukkah with them, and they celebrated Kwanzaa with us, and Christmas with us. We celebrate Kwanzaa very early. Mm-hmm. So it was just a great childhood, great place to grow up.
Yeah.
My dad, as we spoke of earlier, got Sesame Street. That didn't do great things for his marriage to my mother.
Hmm.
Was commuting back and forth from Philly to New York.
I was so about to say that had to be tough. Like Mount Airy, that's a suburb of Philadelphia, but he's doing a show in New York. That's got to be hard.
Yeah, it was. And it was especially hard for my mom. And my dad was kind of doing his thing on the side. So he was, it was rough. It was rough on her. I was confused. You know, I talk about how I love Sesame Street and everything, but you know, as a as a five-year-old and my parents aren't doing good and I'm looking up on a television show that I'm just figuring TV out, right? Mm-hmm. Like, are those people real? Can you reach into the TV? And I'm looking at my daddy walking down the street with another lady named Susan, who's his wife, and some other little kids. I was like,
confused.
Oh my God, I was totally confused. And I was a very, very precocious, chatty child. So yeah. I begged to be on Sesame Street. Everybody on my block got to go up. Everybody got to go up to New York and be on Sesame Street but me.
Oh wow.
And I figured out, I was like, what's going on? Like, where is the, can a girl get some nepotism working here? Like, what are we doing here? And I realized my dad was holding me back. And finally I begged and pleaded, and I got to go up. I had one line. My line was supposed to be "Hi, Gordon," but I kept saying "Hi, Daddy." and I lost my, ended up losing my line. So, you know, so funny. And just recently, Dara, I came across when Bob died, Bob from Sesame Street passed away recently. And when he passed, somebody from his family unearthed and sent me some footage of me on Sesame Street that I've been looking for forever.
Oh, wow.
And I saw me and sit talking with Bob. And when I tell you, I was talking over him, let him finish his story. Then they put me in a scene with the lady drawing. I was trying to grab the pen out the lady's hand to show her how to draw. Then they put me in a scene with my dad. And I was a little more intimidated around my dad. But I was like, okay, I understand why y'all didn't want me on there. I was doing it. I get it. I was doing way too much. But it was this amazing experience, right? It was still like my dad was super, super popular. He hated being in front of the camera. He did not like a writer. His father was a writer for the Negro newspaper in Philadelphia. He had a lot of emotional, generational trauma in his life. I discovered I was in my 20s, where his sister, who was about 8 at the time, and my dad was maybe about 3 or 4, had scarlet fever in Philadelphia. And the white hospital would not treat her.
Oh, my goodness.
Scarlet fever was treatable with antibiotics and all kinds of things, but they wouldn't treat her. Mm. And by the time she got to the black hospital that would treat her, the black doctor, she passed.
Mm.
And that shut down my grandfather, because he almost tried to kill everybody in that white hospital. They had to keep him from, you know, from doing any further damage to the family by losing him by going to jail.
Yeah.
Which is understandable. And then my grandmother became just smothering, overbearing, and a worrywart.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad's father shut down. So he just, the father did not have an emotional thought, emotional person to really go to, and it shut him down. And then he had a younger brother, Gene, who was just a baby when all this happened. So moving forward in his life, when he met my mom, he was this brilliant guy, but he also just had all these emotional blocks in him. So he just couldn't convey love. And he couldn't do that. And I just took it so personally my whole life until he was 21, until I was 21. And he expressed to me, he actually showed me a letter that one of his cousins wrote him about that time and what happened during the time when my Aunt Sheila passed away. And so, gosh, that just opened up everything. You know, like all of a sudden you get this big giant piece of a puzzle laid in your lap about why your father didn't love you, or you thought he didn't love you, or he didn't express love to you. It was so intense. And I'm so glad that I was able to learn that. Now, mind you, at the same time, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease.
Right.
So his body was failing him. He was feeling all kinds of karma stuff, like, you know, this is because I, you know, was a bad father or husband, whatever. Now look at my body's failing me. But this was in the 80s. We didn't have Google, nothing. We didn't have Muhammad Ali wasn't even talking about it. So I just remember being very young, but wanting to help him and wanting to drop out of college to help him. My dad was like all about education. So he was like, you are not dropping out of college to caregive for me. And so, you know, I'll stop there and let you ask quick, because I can go on forever.
I love when people can interview themselves, because I'm just
just sit back and listen. No, but I do want to be that person. So I'm going to stop here, have some more coffee, and let you go.
I've had 34 questions in the course of things, but I just almost prefer to just listen to you talk, because you can go some places that I couldn't. So, well, I guess I want to ask, how did they find your dad? Like, Joan Ganz Cooney was the person who kind of, you know, was over the Children's Television Workshop. And I've kind of told that story in that breakdown about Sesame Street being made for inner city kids. But like, he was in Philly. Like, how did they even find him?
They found him because he was working on a show in Philadelphia. He was a pretty popular Black TV personality in Philadelphia at the local CBS affiliate, WCOU. And basically what he did, he had a show called Black Book. And the show was about Black change makers and society and social change. And he had a show that would make, he wore dashikis. It was heavy, right? And he was talking about things. This was 68. So he was talking about that were going on in the world. And, you know, this was the year Martin Luther King was killed. So it was some heavy stuff going on. And his show was quite popular. And when they were trying to find people to be consultants on Sesame Street, his name came up because of the work he was doing on TV in Philly. Okay. So that's how he became someone in the room. And I have this amazing photo of him. And I almost feel like you used it in your breakdown of him sitting in the room, listening to them talk in this big room with Joan and all these people that were trying to put Sesame Street together. So that's how they found him, based on the work that he was already doing. And there's an article that's so crazy that I still have, that was written in the Philadelphia newspaper. And it was like, the headlines were like, Negro man starts. That's how they started it off. And I always have it everywhere, just to keep me grounded. Like, when I think about, you know, where we are now, Negro man wants to start late night TV show. And it was this big article about how my dad, who was doing some local stuff, had the audacity to think that he could do a national show when there were no Black men on national TV at that part. I think it was like Jack Parr. It was on the Tonight Show or whatever. So that's how they found him, because he was making waves locally in Philadelphia. And then they were like, come on up and consult on the show. And then there was an original Gordon, or OG, that didn't quite pan out. So my dad stepped in.
And why didn't he initially want to be on camera? Was he just kind of a retiring kind of person, and he just didn't feel that he just wasn't comfortable in front of the camera, or why? Why didn't he want to do
that? Like the whole celebrity thing. He hated the whole celebrity.
Even though he was a host, he already did that here in Philly.
Yeah. But he was driving real, like he was driving real stuff, right? Yeah. So he was willing to use his face to do that. But when it came to like doing things that were more actory, he didn't want to do that.
Okay.
Like he was delivering information to the people. Mm-hmm. So that's a different story. But he was able to, based on what Sesame Street was about, he was able to really justify, okay. And he always felt like, I'm going to do this for a little while. But when he saw the opportunity to create Roosevelt and to do music with Roosevelt, because he also loved music, mm-hmm. He was like, oh, you know what? This could work out. So, mm-hmm. But he did not like it. And then I didn't help matters, because when he was Gordon, kids in my neighborhood were like, your daddy's Gordon? And I'm 5 and 6, right? He would come home from New York and all he wanted to do was get him a hoagie and go to sleep.
Yeah.
Right. And he didn't want to be bothered or nothing. But people were like, yo, your dad is Gordon. If you show me your dad, I'll give you 25 cents. So my brother Matt and I were like, yo, there's a little side hustle over here. So, because it was just too easy. You walk in and you peep at him. I would get a quarter. We could go get us some small fries up on Staten Avenue. Like, what? So we did this for a while until we got busted. I am embarrassed to tell that story. But, you know, look, I was a kid just trying to get some extra French fry money. And the money was too easy. It was just too easy. But I felt like I was feeling guilty about that for so many years, because I got punished, obviously, for that. Mm-hmm. I felt like that was the reason why he quit. I felt like that. I was like, me and my little side hustle made him quit, but he just didn't like it. He didn't like it, and he didn't like it. And then I didn't know some of the things that was going on behind the scenes about him trying to get Sesame Street to understand the political climate, understand the mind of a young Black child and what they need to see with the Muppets. Mm-hmm. And so it really wasn't about me. And actually, you know, later on, when my dad and I had this sort of come to Jesus moment, he told me about his childhood trauma, which explained a lot of his issues. He was like, you thought all the whole time is because you was hawking your looking at your dad, come look at Gordon for 25 cents. He goes, it was bad, but that wasn't the reason why.
Was that the reason?
I don't tell that story very much, but no comfortable saying it here.
Well, so what, I guess I kind of want to generally know, because of the weird kind of timeline of when the character stopped appearing on the show. That was much later than when he actually had left the show. So he was going through kind of political stuff behind the scenes and kind of wrestling. Because I actually was going to ask you about that. Like, they brought him on as essentially what we would probably call now as like a diversity consultant. That was part of what he was doing, was making sure to make sure that this stuff was grounded in Blackness, really. I mean, that was part of his job. It's like, we want you here because you are Black and because you work in television, and we don't want a bunch of white folks sitting around in a room deciding what Black children see. But still, behind the scenes, he was not being listened to, it sounds like.
He wasn't.
Yeah, what kind of battles was he fighting, and with whom? I mean, I guess, if you know.
Well, I mean, there were two levels, right? You have to remember, Sesame Street was becoming, it was this you know, public television show, but it was becoming a massive moneymaker.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they were not ready for the money that this show was generating in market and in branding, and the brand, Sesame Street brand, had taken off. Mm-hmm. The very first year, and they were so smart about it, the very first year of the show, they went around and did Sesame Street Live. Mm-hmm. My dad, Will Lee, who was Mr. Hooper, Bob and Susan Loretta Long, who played Susan, they went to these different places and gathered kids together. And Carol Spinney came out as Big Bird. Mm-hmm. And they came out and said, hi, kids, and did little songs. And they were killing the game. I mean, it was out the box. And I think whenever you have that kind of success, but your motives are pure, you know, for you're serving this certain audience, you can get lost between the for-profit and the nonprofit side. Mm-hmm. And I think my dad was trying to say, okay, you know, they can both work, but we have to stay true and not lose sight of what we're doing with these Muppets. Mm-hmm. And that's where Roosevelt came in. Roosevelt Franklin, I mean, I said he was ahead of his time and rapping in his classroom and being at, you know, Roosevelt Franklin's elementary school. But the music, I think right after that music was released, was pretty much the writing on the wall. Mm-hmm. Why? Because, you know, you had Jim Henson and you had all those Muppets that were doing numbers in books and music that were outrageous, right? Kermit the Frog had, you know, It's Not Easy Being Green. I mean, there were some classics, you know, Oscar had I Love Trash. All these songs were written and produced by Joe Raposo.
Joe Raposo
was a goat. When I tell you, this man was so brilliant. Mm-hmm. He wrote, obviously, Sunny Day, Sweeping the Clay. You know, he wrote, obviously, the main song. But all the music was Joe.
Yeah.
Joe and my dad were tight. Mm-hmm. And they're, listen, in any workspace, when you tight with somebody that's the cash cow, there was a lot of jealousy going on. Mm. And I do think that my dad, they were very jealous of my dad. They were very threatened by his brilliance. Mm-hmm. He was so smart and so understood things long before anybody else did. And I think it was threatening to them. Mm. And when Roosevelt's music came out, and then you got Rosalind Cash to play the mother on Roosevelt Franklin, and brought all her Rosalind stuff, you know, like in between Rosalind, Joe, and my dad, they made a spectacular record called from Sesame Street, Roosevelt Franklin. I'm looking at it. The Year of Roosevelt Franklin, Gordon's Friend from Sesame Street. That song to this day, me and my friend Terry, who's in the group En Vogue, we were playing it the other day. It's brilliant. Mm. And it just kind of phased it out. Yeah. And as they did his books too, because he's a brilliant writer. His books, mm-hmm. his books were also amazing. So I just feel like there was a lot of jealousy. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of, you know, it was very successful, and the for-profit piece of it kind of got in the way. You know, and this is not to bash Sesame Street, because let me tell you, I mean, when I look at the show, I still feel like it has a lot of the core values, and the things that they used to do are still there, and they still advocate for kids in a way that's amazing. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that back in the day, they wouldn't listen to him on a lot of things.
Hmm. Which is a shame, because that's what he was there for. So do you feel, I mean, ultimately, at least the way that your mom kind of laid it out in that documentary Street Gang, which I agree, that Street Gang documentary on HBO is incredible. And I used a lot of that footage in my piece, both on the Sesame Street was made for inner city kids, and then the one I did on your dad. But the way that she laid it out, it was where she saw the beginning of the end was when the Black family started to you know, write in and say, hey, this character, Roosevelt Franklin, it's too much. They're too unruly. This is portraying a type of Blackness that we are not comfortable with. They are, you know, inner city Black kids, which, again, the show is targeted to inner city Black kids.
Right. But
this is an image that we don't really want out there. We don't want to be portrayed in this way. One of the points I made in the piece was, like, this is a year after MLK died, you know, 1969, when it first started, when Sesame Street first started, a year after the assassination of MLK. So we kind of have to remember also when, you know, when this was placed, and so very few images of Blackness on television at all. I mean, you could literally count them on one hand. But she, you know, your mom definitely talked about how it was like the beginning of the end when all of this backlash started. How did that impact him?
Yeah. So I did not know any of this one at the time, too young, but I know now that it impacted him. And by the way, I learned so much from my mom during watching her. I wasn't there when she shot her portion of the documentary, but I learned so much from her, talking about how my dad was impacted. Yeah, it was demoralizing for him that the people that were coming for Roosevelt and coming for what he felt was important to reflect were Black parents. In hindsight, I get it, because I do understand that it was during a time where our image was very important And we didn't really have a lot of those images. You know, they, I think they might've tried to get him to tone it down. I'm glad that they, that he didn't as a result, because there's going to come a time when we're going to, I don't know, maybe you and I will do it together, but we need to do really a deep dive on Roosevelt Franklin, not just Sesame Street, but on Roosevelt. Mm. And really, you know, I think what he meant to the two Black children at that time. Mm. If parents were looking and going, oh, well, Roosevelt's in class and he's, you know, he's the teacher and he's cutting up and rapping. And he's doing this, that, and the other, you know, but it was all these hidden gems in there. Like they did this whole rap about, you know, my dad was crazy about his names. It was always somebody's name, you know, Wet Mop Weaver, or, you know, Lonesome Lewis. And like,
they were cool names.
Mobody Mosley. I mean, everybody had a name. But there was a moment, you know, in the classroom, I have a video of when they're talking about South Africa.
Okay. Yeah.
South Africa. And they say, well, what do you think was in South Africa? And then, you know, the kids in the class were like, lions and tigers and jungles. And there's Roosevelt teaching this story about, oh, no, over here, there's only this much jungle. But over here are diamonds. Mm-hmm. And over here are other resources in the world. And here there's buildings, there's office buildings. So this was in the early 70s. So, you know, being able to teach kids about what's in Africa other than Tarzan, you know what I mean? That was a big deal. So I just felt like he was just too far ahead of his time. I mean, it's just like these are really great lessons on the power of, you know, the blackness and in the world, that we're not just, you know. And so for some kid that's sitting in Harlem watching this, and then to look up and go, hey, you know, did you know there were diamonds in South Africa, and there's these mines, and then there's this and there's that, you know what I mean? So anyway, they were just things that I think were just, they weren't ready for. It was a little too deep. And the fact that the Black parents were coming in, remember, this was a show that was banned in some Southern states, right? So they were Mississippi, they didn't even want to play Sesame Street just because they had Black people on it. Mm-hmm. So I think that, my dad, just the information that he wanted to share just wasn't on their agenda. Mm. And that's okay. I'm glad he didn't acquiesce. I'm glad he came with it how he saw it, and that it aired, and that we have it. Mm-hmm. That was sort of the beginning of the end. And then he would go on to do other things.
Mm-hmm. So what was, because you're mid-60s, 1964, you were born, is that right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so by the time he left, you would have been still a very young child, like 7 or 8 years old or something like that.
Yeah.
How did your life change once he left the show? How did your lives change once he left?
I was mad. I was mad. That was my hookup.
Did you get to see like the hands up the butts of the Muppets? Because I've seen those pictures mess me up now as an adult. I can't imagine being a child and being like, Kermit's got somebody's hand up his rear.
I saw more than that, because I saw we would have parties at our house. We would have like cast parties in Philly at our house. And Carol Spinney would come. Now Carol was my heart. Carol was Oscar and Big Bird.
Yeah.
Carol would come, and Carol would just like take the Big Bird's head off and be just walking around with his head out. And I'd be like, oh, this is traumatizing. But as a young girl, when you see it and you're like, okay, I get this TV thing. I understand that, you know, I get it. But yeah, it was a little traumatizing. But so I was so aware of, you know, the process at Sesame Street at a young age. So it didn't freak me out. And it was just really cool to be able to, you know, experience that actually being such a little girl.
Oh, that's cool. Well, that's cool. And so after that, can you just kind of talk about what that was like for you all as a family when he left? I mean, what happened? How did your lives like shift?
Well, it was traumatizing because my mom and dad were not getting along. Mm. So that was happening behind the scenes and trying to figure out what that looked like. Right. So he's now out of a job. He's being unfaithful to her, somebody in New York. Mm-hmm. She's feeling some kind of way. She was a, you know, in her own right, she was doing things in Philly too. She was an on-camera person in Philadelphia as well, mm-hmm. doing these kid shows too. Like my mom was, she was like low key, really, really like just a gangster. Like, I don't understand how she was doing things like she was doing. She was a school teacher, basically, mm-hmm. born and raised in poverty. And when she met my dad, she thought he was brilliant. And that's what really turned her on about him, that he was just so smart. But their relationship was rough. But she did go on to create her own like little niche in Philadelphia as well, little local TV shows. Mm. And then when Sesame Street was over, I think it kind of triggered something in her. And she was like, you know what? I got to go. I got to get out of Philly. I got to reinvent. And she took us, me and my brother, put us in a station wagon and drove us across country to Los Angeles, more specifically Malibu, where there wasn't one other black face. Flip Wilson's kids were there. Now, you're probably too young to remember Flip Wilson. But
I know about Flip Wilson. Yeah, well,
you know about, because you know about everybody before and after your time. But Flip Wilson,
I think he and Gladys Knight had a show really briefly in the 80s that was kind of a Cosby, sort of kind of Cosby thing. I don't know if anyone remembers this.
I don't remember that, but you just triggered it in my brain. I think I know what show you're talking about. But Flip was everything in the 70s. Like,
yeah,
the show was so popular on TV. Yep. And him cross-dressing and Geraldine, and he had a whole character. And I mean, he was just brilliant. And so we moved to Malibu, which I was miserable. My brother was like, yeah, where are we going? We on a vacation, on an adventure. But I was miserable. And but Flip's kids were the only other black kids in the neighborhood. So we were traumatized. And my dad he didn't really have any wherewithal to be mad at my mom because he was not a good husband. So she needed to get out. But I mean, man, it was such a culture shock. And my dad would write me these long letters about, you're moving to La La Land. He hated LA. Mm-hmm. And you're moving to where people don't know the difference between blood and ketchup. And he would write because my dad was a serious writer. So he'd write me these unbelievable letters that would be, oh my God, they were so deep. I have them all and they were so deep.
Oh, how cool. You still have them.
I do. Wow. I'm gonna show them and share them at some point, but they're so intense. He just never wrote me just a regular birthday letter. It would always be like, well, my shipment of South African diamonds was late, so I wasn't able to get you anything. But what I will tell you is something you can keep for the rest of your life. And that is, you know, that I love you. And like, he started to tell me that when I was in my 20s, which was awesome. But yeah, so then that second sort of season of my childhood happened on the West Coast when my dad did not want to move out there. He hated LA, but he had to. That's where the writing gigs were.
Yeah.
He went out and he moved to LA begrudgingly. But he ended up getting writing gigs on the Jeffersons, on a show called Eight is Enough, which was a huge hit. The Waltons, which was a huge hit. And Sanford and Son. Mm-hmm. So his buddy, Stan Lathan, who's a famous director, also Sanaa Lathan's father.
Okay.
For his Philadelphia buddy, was a director on Sanford and Son and got my dad a writing job.
Okay.
He's like, Matt, you got to come out of LA. You got to come out of New York and you got to come to LA. This is where it is. So he came and he did that.
Okay.
So, so he continued his career after Sesame Street, as a television writer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So he at least physically was near you guys and you got to kind of be in his presence, still, even though they were kind of not mostly together at that point.
Yeah, they did not like each other at all. And that was weird as a child, you know, divorce, you just blame yourself and you feel like, what did I do or what did I say or all that. But at the end of the day, like, she was pretty good about not, you know, turning us against him or anything like that. She couldn't stand his ass, but she was very nice about not making us feel that way. Even though he made that very hard. She just did a good job doing that. Yeah. And my dad, on the other hand, you know, they just had two different ways of seeing things. Now, my mom now was, okay, she's free now. We get to go to, you know, she's not under his thumb. She's not just in Philly, you know, no offense against Phily, but like she just, everyone thought she was crazy to try to make this trip cross country. Mm-hmm. We were fortunate enough to get the house for, we had no money. Fortunate enough to get the house of Cleavon Little, amazing actor who's a movie called Blazing Saddles. He was good friends with my mom and my dad. And my dad was pissed at him because he gave us his house. Wow. While he went on Broadway, he had a house in Malibu. He said, you and Holly and Matt can come stay here for free because we didn't have anybody. And he introduced her to his agent and she got a job on the agent's desk.
That's so cool. I read up on your mom because I kept, you know, I follow her on Instagram now and she'll post, you know, different pictures with when Paul Rubens passed and she posted a picture with him. Like, she knows a ton of people. Clearly she's been in the business somehow. So I went and started doing my research on her and she, you know, her career has been just incredible. Was she like, she was an agent? Is that what she ended up?
No, being? She was a manager. So she ended up, she was on an agent's desk. And the agency represented LeVar Burton. And this was the eve of Roots. And on the eve of Roots, it hadn't even come out yet. And somehow she snuck into a screening and was like, oh my God. And she found, you know, connected with LeVar. He was only like 19, a student at USC. And the agency had already planned, was making a deal for him to go become like a runaway slave regular on Grizzly Adams. My mom was like, that ain't the career move. No. That ain't it. It was so bizarre. So she took that intel and went to LeVar with it. And he was like, yeah, I know, but they're going to give me $50,000. That's like, I don't have any money. That's a lot of money. And my mom was like, I will give you $50,000 of my own money not to take the job. She didn't have $1,000. So she managed to convince him that to go with her, let me manage your career because you got so much that you're going to be able to do. You are going to be the Michael Jordan of slaves by lack of a better term. You cannot go from being Kunta Kinte to playing some slave on TV and some show. Anyway, he didn't call her bluff. He went with her and they started a great career. So she's a manager and then she went on to manage Wesley Snipes and Rosie Perez and Michael Clark Duncan and Martin Sheen, Pierce Brosnan. She's had an amazing career. And I didn't even start working with her until I was out of college. So
your mom is just something else.
I mean, something else. Yeah. When you do the mom's version of this.
Yeah.
You know, I can talk more about her. She is. But at the end of the day, my dad was really threatened by her because, you know, she wasn't supposed to come out to L.A. and do all that.
Yeah.
And she hit it big. And then I went off to go to college. And that was around the time where my dad started to really open up to me about, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. And he was really emotional about, you know, his health and wanted to really have a talk with me about how he could have been a better dad and talked about what happened as a child, which he never talked about. Mm. And tried to explain that that's why he probably wasn't as good a dad as he could have been. And boy, that was a moment. Like I remember that like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, just him opening up to me and just being, you know, transparent during that time. It was quite deep, but it was a breakthrough moment in our lives. And that Parkinson's just took him down, you know, just he passed at such a young age. So, but he inspired a life of service for me and left such a tremendous legacy.
Yeah. I, you know, just listening to you tell that part of your story with your dad, again, I'm kind of just in this space of like dads, and I don't know why, because my father passed. My father's name was Doyle Tucker, and he was a musician. He was a music minister. And so we traveled all over the United States and lived here, there, and everywhere because of him. But he was an unusual type. But he passed away at 63. So right, you know, very close to the age that your dad did. But in he passed away of brain cancer, which in a way kind of feels like when people tell stories about diseases like Parkinson's or what is the other illness that reminds me a lot of it, but it just, you know, Alzheimer's, yes, where it's just this degenerative kind of thing. What we dealt with our dad, he passed in 2014, it felt like a bit of the same kind of thing, but just in fast motion, just fast forward that process. But we went through it all in probably 3 months, and then he was gone, you know, 3 to 6 months. We were not aware of it, and he didn't make us aware of it. And it was a very dramatic situation how it all went down. I will not get into it now, but I think when he knew that he was ill, he wrote us a letter. And this is why you're kind of evoking something that feels very similar, because he wrote us this whole kind of expository thing. And it was just like, this is the reason that I've, you know, made certain decisions, and just all kinds of things that he normally would not have been so revelatory with us about. I don't even know that he knew he was ill when he wrote it, but he knew something was wrong. He knew something was off. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, Daddy, I see why, you know, certain things have happened in the way that they haven't. And we still have that letter too, you know, which helps us to really kind of reason and grapple with some of the decisions that he was making kind of later in his life. So that degenerative thing, which we got to watch happen right before our eyes, it was an honor to be there with him in the hospital and just be beside him in that process. And I know that for you, like, you did take on that caretaker role. He didn't want you necessarily to have to do that, but you did end up doing that, which I deeply identify with. Can you just talk to me about what that process was like? Because that's a long time for your dad to be ill from early 80s, and he didn't pass away until the early 2000s. I can't even imagine having to walk that process out for 2 decades. What does that do to you? What was that experience like?
Well, first of all, thank you for sharing that story. And the way that you laid that out, it was just, it's just making me emotional, because it just, it was just a period of time, you know, when you just kind of shorten that period of time that you went through in just months, based on the 20 years of just that degeneration, it just, everything breaking down, you know, like.
I just can't even imagine. I can't get my head around it, Holly. I'm serious. For us to do that for 2 months, I cannot imagine what that process is. And
the only thing that there was joy was that there were good days, right? There were days where we find a medicine that worked and he was doing good and he was kind of feeling. And then we would get, you know, there would be medical breakthroughs. There would be moments where there was like, you know, we'd learn about this kind of deep brain stimulation thing that we could get him. But the timing was such that it wasn't until, you know, years later when we really had those things down. Do you know what I mean? Like, so it wasn't until years later. And so he didn't get the benefit of knowing how much exercise would have helped him.
Wow.
I remember telling him, we started to hear those things. And I remember telling him, Dad, if you exercise, it's going to make your symptoms go away. And he would be like, exercise? Hell, I can't even button my shirt. Mm-hmm. You want me to exercise? Like, and I'd be like, you know, it was really hard because he was just so frustrated. He didn't really understand why his body was doing this.
Yeah.
It wasn't until 2002 when Muhammad Ali came to our Hollyrod Foundation fundraiser, when it changed, it put Hollyrod on the map, put our nonprofit on the map. He said he would come, him and his wife said he would come. And I was like, yeah, right. And then when he showed up, we were about to fold it up because it was really too hard for us to fundraise, because it was Michael J. Fox and nobody. This was when we were really just fundraising for Parkinson's and compassionate care, not autism yet. But anyway, when the champ came and was at the event and sat and talked with him and was just like, yo, man, look at what we're doing. Like, look at this, you know, hang in there, and gave him that love. Mm-hmm. It lifted him so much for quite a bit of time until he started sort of going downhill again. But I think what triggered my tears and what made me emotional was just, you know, it just realizing there was so much time, but so much of the time was spent where he couldn't talk and he couldn't express himself and he couldn't walk. He was just, you know, his body was just frozen due to Parkinson's. And so even though there was essentially almost 20 years from the time he was diagnosed to the time he passed away, they weren't quality, you know, because, and they, you know, I'd had babies and he really couldn't connect with them or talk to them. You know, my third baby, second pregnancy, because I had twins first, I was 9 months pregnant when my dad passed away. Mm. And I delivered probably like, you know, well, let's see. Yeah. Probably by a week after we laid him to rest.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was intense, but you know, those days were hard, but I talk a lot about the caregiving piece because I know there's a lot of people out there that are caregiving for their fathers and their loved ones right now. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard. And I'm always telling people to make sure you get your care too.
Yeah.
Like, make sure you care for yourself because you cannot pour from an empty cup. You just can't. Now, I was like 19 and a lot younger when he first got diagnosed, and then, you know, still pretty young when he was, when he passed. But, you know, now in the pushing 60, like, it's hard to take care of people. And especially if you're in the sandwich generation where you're taking care of kids and, you know, and your parents. So that caregiving was tough. It was really hard, but I've spoken a lot about it. I try to advocate for caregivers as much as I can, try to tell them to get their care in as well, to walk, to exercise, to meditate, to do all kinds of things to help them not lose themselves so that they can take better care of the people they love.
Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking about, you know, the logistics of your life. And we've been aware of a lot of this because you've done a pretty good job communicating a lot of this to us. So I've been aware of, you know, the fact that you were a caretaker for your father. I've been aware of the fact that, you know, you were a mom and a wife and you were having, you know, multiple children. You didn't have a small family. I mean, you really went for it. And so just to think about, as you said, being that sandwich generation, having a father who was ill while having your children at the same time. And it's just amazing to me that you have had any kind of a career in this, you know, in these ensuing years. I mean, how did all of that, I guess, impact your ability to focus on your actual career being an actress and, you know, doing the various things that you do? I mean, what was that like? Was it just like shut everything down and just focus on this?
It was just having a great team between my husband, who was playing football at the time, who's very understanding. He wasn't always there, but when he was present.
Yeah.
Between my mom, who basically helped me raise my twins and all my kids, but especially my twins, that allowed me to go back to work. I went to work on that show, For Your Love. I was pregnant during the pilot and went back to work on that show when the twins were 3 months old. I couldn't have done that without a great team around me. Mm-hmm. You know, some people I hired, but basically my family was there. Like, they just picked up the slack and said, okay, you know, you still got to work. You got to get out there. And then just people that just were so, I call them angels on the path, right? You know, those people in your life that just say, I see what you're trying to do, and I'm going to make it easier.
Yes.
Yvette Lee Bowser. Now, she's somebody who is someone I went to high school with, who ended up she's the executive producer and showrunner, writer, creator of For Your Love. But she also created Living Single. She also created or wrote on A Different World. She, Dear White People, she worked on, and Run the World. I think she's a co-executive producer, creative. I mean, she's just a juggernaut. This is a Black woman who was my buddy in high school when we were 15. Never thought we would end up being doing TV together. But when I had those twins and they were 3 months old, she created a nursery for me so I could go to work. I could have that nursery there. She knew when it was time for me to nurse. So she's like, okay, get in there. I see what's going on. Let's go. Like she made a space for me to be a professional and work and raise kids at the same time. Mm. She also was pregnant around the same time. So, and there was another cast member that had a baby. So she created a space for us to work and raise kids.
Wow.
But not for her, I don't think I would have ever had the chance to work so soon, to go back to work so soon, and yet still feel so completely connected to my twins.
Wow.
So for obvious reasons, she's the godmother of my kids, and she's somebody that I love so much. And I just shout her out because every now and then those people come around that will make your life so much easier and allow you to achieve the dreams and goals that you are looking for. And when it's a Black woman who was, again, ahead of her time and what she was creating, she's just my favorite person. Like I think of her and I go, wow, like we need 50,000 more Yvettes in this world.
Yeah. And then it just, goes to show when space is given and when space is created for people that don't necessarily fit the profile of those that should be successful. So you have a Black woman here who's creating a space for another Black woman. There are all kinds of great things that can come from that. And it's so necessary. And it's one of the reasons that focusing on diversity and equity and inclusion in all spaces is so important. And I hate the idea that is being minimized in any way right now in our culture, because you never know the stories that will come from that. Just creating space, understanding what the needs are on a deeper level. I mean, if you had a man that was a boss that was a white man, it's very possible that wouldn't have happened for you. And so, hearing more of those stories, I think, is essential.
It's very possible, and it is one of those things where I think I realized it at the time. I couldn't believe it. Obviously I was very grateful, but looking back and trying to see spaces where that might happen today, I don't think they're there. So that was a game changer for me, to continue doing what I wanted to do. And that show, that body of work, those 89 or 90 episodes that we were able to produce of that show, they're some of my favorite TV moments, and they don't happen if Yvette Lee Bowser does not say, bring them babies to work and we will work the schedule around you.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I have to go find that show now because you've talked about it.
Yes, we do. We've been begging. I think TV, Bounce TV has it on now. I think we've been trying to lobby to get it streamed. And I think now that there's this crazy strike, I have a feeling that we're going to be seeing it. They just keep going in the coffers to get more content. Mm-hmm. But yes, please check out For Your Love. You will love it. It's so cute. And it's funny and it's still relevant. And we had amazing, I was just looking the other day at just the list of guest stars that we've had, everyone from Naomi Campbell to Shaquille O'Neal to just really fun stuff. So
that's so cool. Yeah. And I don't want to let you go before I talk about your work with autism. You were one of the early folks that kind of brought this, that to our awareness, autism to our awareness. And now since then, I've had several nieces and nephews that have been diagnosed with autism or somewhere on the spectrum. And I think for a lot of people, we all have had, our lives have all been impacted by autism in some way. If there are, especially if there are young people in your life, if you have children, nieces, nephews, grandchildren, somebody somewhere, a friend's child or something, you're going to probably know somebody whose life has been impacted by autism. And I've heard you speak very frankly and very honestly about the fear that you first dealt with when that diagnosis first came, but then you have just found a way to create such activity and beauty and creativity and just, awareness around it since then. So can you kind of speak to parents who are maybe going through this? Because I have, multiple siblings who have children who have been diagnosed with this and they are in the thick of it. They're, fighting that battle day to day. So can you kind of talk to those parents or caretakers?
I could talk for hours and hours about this topic. So I'm going to try to tap into my concise gene, which I really don't possess. The reason why we started talking about autism was because when we got the diagnosis in 2000, we saw no books. Mm. We saw no celebrity platforms being used, even though we knew people in the Hollywood community that had people that had children on the spectrum, but chose not to speak about it. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But it's not for everyone to share their business. Mm-hmm. At first, Rodney didn't want me to talk about it because he didn't want to label his boy.
Yeah.
Right. He didn't want to label his child and he didn't want to limit him.
Yeah.
But I was like, if we talk about it, somebody else will see and will feel seen and heard. Mm-hmm. And that will take so much. Oh, sorry. My husband just came in. I'm doing a live. Oh, you want the dog in? Okay. Sorry. Live.
It's okay.
Dog was scratching to get in here. And so for us, we knew we had to share our story. Mm-hmm. Because we did not see anyone having these conversations.
Yeah.
And I felt so disenfranchised when I got the diagnosis. Mm. We were told everything our son would never do. He was 3 years old. And one of the things they said he would never do was, there were so many things, but one was have meaningful employment. Mm. Now, as he's 25 and just left for work, in his car, which they said he'd never drive.
Wow.
Share his life. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't see any examples of what the possibilities would be for RJ. Mm-hmm. Nobody, and people may have been sharing them in ways that I didn't see, but I didn't see anybody using their platform in a real meaningful, aggressive way. Mm-hmm. So we had that conversation. Rodney didn't want to really share. I did. I won because I win all the arguments. Let's keep it real. I win them all. I just had a sheer persistence. No, I presented to him. I said, I know this will be better in the long run. You'll see. We're going to be able to help so many people. And much like we were doing for Parkinson's, even mm-hmm. talking about Parkinson's disease, which was something a lot of people weren't talking about in caregiving and what the compassionate care that these families need. And so it was important that we share our story. And we shared it via two reality shows. We did one for OWN Network called For Pete's Sake. And then Hallmark picked it up after OWN Let It Go, called Meet the Petes. And we talked about everything that this young man did, from him dealing with online bullying, from him dealing with bullying at school, from him trying to get his driver's license, what that was like, saving his money, him and the police getting stopped, what that looks like for a Black child or young man with autism to get stopped by the police. We knew we had so many stories and aspects of what autism looks like, especially in the Black community. Mm-hmm. And we had to share it. And so that's the mission that we've been on really for the last, I want to say I want to say this to people who may be just getting the diagnosis. I haven't always been Norma Rae pumping my fist, standing up on a, you know, platform. When RJ got the diagnosis, I went inward. Rodney mm-hmm. went inward, like denial inward. And he got out of that. Thank God. But I didn't even want to share the story. It wasn't until he was nine, like 7 or 8, where I really started talking publicly about it. And I went on the Oprah show and cried my eyes out and, like, you know, did all that. I say that because I don't want people to think that when you get it, you just go, okay, let's roll up our sleeves. And now it's a process, and there's a grieving process, and you got to go through that. That said, this has been a journey of advocacy that I feel so blessed to be part of. I love talking to families. I spend probably, I want to say, 25% of my life talking on the phone to families. Just giving them 2 hours at a time, just saying, hey, this is what I wish somebody would have told me. Yeah. I didn't have any guidance. But at the end of the day, autism is a disorder that a lot of people don't even know what it is. It's a disorder that you see manifested through communication and speech. it's a spectrum disorder. All that means is it's on a spectrum that can be, you can be a child who's nonverbal and you know, can't connect verbally, but can connect in other ways. Mm-hmm. Can be a child who's highly verbal, but you can't look someone in the eye and make a friend. Mm-hmm. So many different ways and all the ways in between. And when we saw the amount of the prevalence and the amount of people who were impacted by autism, yeah. but no one was talking for them, giving yeah. them some kind of platform, we were like, oh, we got to do this. So yeah. it's been an awesome journey. Holly Wright Foundation morphed into an awesome autism organization as well as Parkinson's. And it's been just it's God's mission for me. And I somebody told me that when he first got diagnosed, and I think I cussed them out so bad, like, oh, this is what God wants you to do. I said, no, you know, that's not what you want to hear when you first get the diagnosis, because you feel like you're so lost and freaked out. And like yeah. someone's telling you this is a blessing. I was like, get up out of here with that blessing. But when I tell you the blessings, when I tell you the people that have stopped us, and told us the difference that our advocacy and us talking about it and the hope that RJ's situation gave them.
Yeah. Yes.
I just feel overwhelmed. It's yeah. overwhelming. Just made me cry today, girl. I was going to wear my eyelashes for you, but I'm glad I didn't, because they would have been off.
Well, I mean, you reached, you know, I was probably in college at that time. And, you know, when that diagnosis would have happened, or when you started talking about it or whatever. But I mean, shoot, I was in Oklahoma at the time. You reached me, you know, someone who otherwise would not have known anything really about autism. And like I said, I didn't know what it was. And right. I didn't have nieces and nephews who had been diagnosed. And now I do. And it's like, it's not as scary as it would have been if you hadn't done the work that you had. So
that is
thank
so
you.
Happy to hear. Makes me so happy to hear. And you know, we saw that there were no books, so we wrote them. We wrote like yeah. five books between our family. Rodney wrote a book called Not My Boy, you know, and just talking about this, you know, him having to get out of denial, basically. I thought that mm-hmm. was really powerful, because a lot of times dads process this differently, especially Black dads yeah. that are Black who
yeah.
in our community, you know, we don't talk about this stuff. So mm-hmm. very important. And then I wrote books with RJ and also with his twin sister. And so we have My Brother Charlie and Charlie Makes a Splash. Those are two children's books. Mm-hmm. And then there's a book called Same But Different. And that is a book about middle school, because kids in middle school can, I don't know why they can be so cruel yeah. and cold-blooded, but that was a real difficult time for RJ at school. And we shared that. So, you know, I will continue to support families. I will continue to advocate for not only autism, but for Parkinson's. My brother, Matt, has Parkinson's. Not sure if you knew that.
Yes. Yes.
Yep. So Matt is only 62-ish, and he mm-hmm. was diagnosed in his 50s, young onset, mm-hmm. like my dad. And so we will continue to advocate for those families as well, and for compassionate care, and to talk about a lot of the great things that Parkinson's, the breakthroughs, been so many amazing breakthroughs mm-hmm. Right now. A lot of great advocacy. We'll continue to do that.
Yeah. I don't want to let you go before asking you how Matt is doing. How is your brother doing?
Right now, he's not doing so great. Like he just called the other day and he's like, you know, this damn disease, like it's a real mind game, mm-hmm. because you have to trick this basically synthetic dopamine. You have to trick this into how it works in your body. People with Parkinson's or know about or have loved ones with Parkinson's will understand when your body's on and your body's off, mm-hmm. right? So the idea of these medicines, you have to sort of play this crazy game with them in order to get your body to respond properly. Mm-hmm. but he's doing some great therapies. There are some really awesome surgery options these days for mm-hmm. deep brain stimulation, where people actually have, you know, they actually have, what's the word I'm looking for? Not
implants.
Implants in mm-hmm. their brains. Sounds scary, but it is doing some miraculous work, results for people to just function in life.
Yeah.
So he's doing just okay right now.
Mm-hmm.
But my brother is, he's the life of the party. Like Matt is happy go, you know, back in high school when you get the best popular and most popular mm-hmm. best personality, Matt got happy go lucky. Like he's that cat. So he has a very bright outlook on everything. The thing that he's doing the most that's helping him is boxing.
Mm, oh, wow.
Parkinson's boxing. Uh-huh. So that's something that is very, very, and the irony that, you know, Muhammad Ali and then the boxing and that yeah. is really cool. So, you know, anybody out there that's dealing with Parkinson's or dealing with someone, a loved one with Parkinson's, you know, move, keep them moving.
Yeah.
Keep moving. That is really an amazing way to stave off these symptoms and to mm-hmm. have a better quality of life.
Yeah. Well, Holly, thank you so much for sharing just so much of your life with us. You're just one of those folks who people feel like they know because you have been so generous about just sharing your life and the struggles that you've dealt with and the joys and all of it. And it's like, it's somebody's going to connect with it. Somebody's going to identify with it. So you're more than just an actress. You're a whole person. So thank you for being a whole person for us and for sharing about your dad here, because I feel like he should.
Thank you for having this amazing idea. When I first, I'm going to give you some flowers real quick. Mm-hmm. When I first saw you, the first time I think I saw you was when you were doing that breakdown on Sesame Street. I might have seen a couple other ones too, but that one obviously caught my eye because it was mm-hmm. about my dad, and it was so beautifully done.
Oh, thank
it was
you,
so Holly. Beautifully done. It was made. It was thoughtful. It was. I'm like, wow, this lady's really. You're just a real gift to us.
Thank you.
You're a real gift. You have the most fantabulous voice. Like your voice is so smooth, and then you just the information that you share with us in a way that we can really hear it. It's fabulous. It's thought provoking, and it's something that I look forward to whenever now that I follow you or see you, I'm like, oh, what's she going to talk about? Like, how is she going to deliver it? So thank you for having this idea to, you're thinking about your dad.
Yeah.
Thank you for including me. Sorry, I was so emotional.
No, I'm, hey.
Like, I mean, it's just, you understand, you know, we love our
dad.
And seeing them leave us is tough.
It's tough.
Even leave us is tough. My dad, the anniversary of his death was just a couple weeks ago.
Wow.
And I always know that because my son, right, his birthday, he was born just a very short time after my dad passed. So we always laugh and say they crossed each other and they are very much alike in so many ways. And like somehow my son knows all the songs that my dad used to listen to, Louis Jordan and like old blues songs and stuff. I'm like, how do you know that song? He's like, hello. So anyway, thank you for this time and I appreciate it. And
absolutely. Ooh, just
talking for a while. Just look at how much time we've been gone by. I appreciate you so much. And so anytime you want to talk again, please reach out.
I might be tugging on your coattails again, but thank you for making time for me, Holly. I really appreciate it. This is so meaningful. And I'm so looking forward to sharing this with people.
My pleasure. Let's talk again soon.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. Right. Thank you
Take
so
care.
Much.
You All right. Got it.